Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to another fantastic episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I, as always, am your host, Brian J. Rowan, joined by my ranger companions, Nick Newman, associate editor for The Film Stage.
Hello.
Danny King, a writer for The Film Stage.
Hello, bright and early.
Woo! This is a 9 a.m. recording on Sunday morning, so if we're sounding a little tired, or perhaps a little holy... Now you know why. And we're also joined today for a very, very special podcast about the Will Smith M. Night Shyamalan movie After Earth by sometimes Film Stage contributor Ethan Vespi.
Hey.
Hey, how have you been?
All right. A little early, but we'll see what happens.
Well, you know, Rangers rise early. That's not from the movie, but I assume that that's something.
I bet Will Smith, at least in the backstory graphic novel, says that at one point.
So as I said, today we will be talking about After Earth, the newest film by director M. Night Shyamalan, starring Jaden and Will Smith. Before we get into that, we're going to be talking about our personal history and feelings with M. Night Shyamalan. How we think his movies have done, which we thought were successes, which we thought were failures. Before we get even to that, though, I'd like to remind you that you can use the chapter selection arrows at the bottom of your podcast player to skip between chapters. So if you hear the non-spoiler section, then you want to go and see the movie, then you want to come back, but you don't want to have to listen through everything again to get to the spoilers, you can do that. Also, make sure to give us a rating and a comment on iTunes, and if you ever have need to speak with us directly, you can email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. So let's kick it off. Let's begin. Want to talk about the work of M. Night Shyamalan, who at one point was being trumpeted as the new Hitchcock, probably a little bit prematurely, as is now obvious. But, you know, a lot of people have a lot of feelings on his movies, and we might be surprised by some of the movies of his that we actually enjoyed. So, I guess we should start off with the most obvious one. He had two smaller films before The Sixth Sense, Praying with Anger and Wide Awake. Has anyone even seen those?
I've seen Wide Awake.
And what were your thoughts on that?
Well, I talk about it in the article I wrote on thefilmstage.com. But it's him kind of before he became like an outright formalist. So the movie is a little... It's a little, I don't want to criticize it for being sentimental, but I guess mawkish is maybe the right word. But overall, I think it has its heart in the right place, and it's a sign of things to come.
All right, excellent. No one else saw this, though, right?
No, we haven't.
All right.
So, Rosie O'Donnell plays a teacher who also really is into sports, and she teaches at a Catholic school. So she's always equating lessons in the Bible to, like, baseball or football or...
I need to see this movie now. Oh, my God. Is this pre-insanity, Rosie Donald?
I think she was always a little crazy.
That's probably a good point. Okay, so then we have his breakthrough film, The Sixth Sense. I'm assuming that we have all seen this.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
All right, Nick, what did you think of The Sixth Sense?
Well, it's been a number of years since I've seen it, close to 10 probably. But, you know, my estimation of it at that time was quite positive, and I've seen parts of it on cable in the years since. It plays, you know, every so often. Sometimes TNT will get it in their head to show it 8 times a week, and I'm always stopping by it when it comes on and giving it a gander, and the movie still impresses. And I think that even with sort of I think a few of his later films kind of have a cloud over them, kind of knowing the career troubles Shyamalan would go through later on, but that movie is still quite impressive. I do think that it is a little I don't want to say mawkish, like
it's pretty sentimental, actually.
The word mawkish has never gotten greater rotation than it is on this podcast already.
It is very sentimental, but I think that it actually is, to a positive degree, kind of shows Shyamalan to have a lot of empathy for his characters, and something that I don't think he gets enough credit for in his career. It's kind of an interesting, well, maybe not a start there, because apparently Wide Awake kicks that off, but it is still good, and I think that it kind of, you would almost not expect that. You would sort of think that watching it, there'd be kind of a negative connotation to a lot of it because of what later happened.
Mm-hmm.
But it still works. It does.
All right. Everyone, I mean, I agree with that. I think that The Sixth Sense is still a very well-made and entertaining film. Does anyone have any... Has anyone been poisoned on that movie in the years to come? Or are we all still a fan?
I like it, but I'll say it's not one of my favorites.
Of his or just in general?
Of his.
Okay. Danny, what about yourself?
Yeah, I remember liking it, but like Nick, it's been a while. As with most of his films, really, I haven't seen any of them within a few years. And I remember Sixth Sense. I didn't see it in a theater. I was just kind of like a silly teenager, and I remember coming across it on like a best twist endings movie list. So I like knew the ending going in because I was just like a little bit of an idiot. But it didn't ruin the film to my recollection. I recall liking it quite a bit.
After The Sixth Sense, we move on to the movies that I guess led some people to believe that he was flagging. The duo of Unbreakable and Signs. And these are movies that I found have actually split people pretty regularly. So I know that I personally loved Unbreakable. I thought that it was just a really well-crafted and very interesting and original kind of superhero origin story. And it kind of was kicking off the whole making superheroes real before Batman Begins even got into that game. What were other people's thoughts on Unbreakable? Did anyone like this movie as much as I did?
I think of his I'll say Holy Trilogy. I think it's his best film.
Wait, Holy Trilogy?
I'll just say The Village, Lady in the Water, and The Happening.
Yeah, and Danny, Nick, what about yourselves? What about Unbreakable?
Yeah, that's my favorite film of his, and it's kind of... I remember seeing it in the theater when it came out, and I was sort of not... You know, I was at a young age, but I still kind of had expectations for it based on The Sixth Sense, and it really is not that kind of film, mm-hmm. even though there is a twist ending and... There are similar concepts being grappled with. It is actually a pretty different movie altogether, and
it definitely is. And I feel like a lot of people unfairly kind of pin it with the like hackneyed twist label.
Yeah,
but I never really felt that way about it.
Yeah, I mean there is a twist, but it's not the same kind of twist.
It's not like a paradigm shifting everything has changed twist. Like it's literally
exactly.
Just a character revelation.
Yes. But I think that that's actually, you know, I talked about how the Sixth Sense shows a lot of empathy for his characters. I think Unbreakable is by far his most touching film.
No, that's The Happening.
God. Do I even continue?
Oh, my God. Take a breath. You can do this.
But anyway, sorry about that. No, I mean, I think that Unbreakable definitely kind of, I think that family dynamic, which is in the movie with Bruce Willis, his son, and Robin Wright, or back when it was Robin Wright Penn, is really, really moving and effective. I think of particularly there's the scene where the son pulls a gun on his father to kind of try and prove if he really is immortal. And I think that sequence actually demonstrates a lot of Shyamalan's strengths as a filmmaker, which people don't give him enough credit for. There's how it's all done in, you know, these very long shots, and there's so much raw, naked emotion packed into those shots, and there's this silence to it, too, which kind of... I think, you know, in the past, he's definitely been guilty of kind of overemphasizing his music, but it's moments like those where he really emphasizes the silence, and... you know, it's kind of the way he brings these events to a head in this unexpected way, I think is really commendable. And I don't think he really did it as well since. I'm not sure exactly how. I find it kind of strange that Unbreakable to me feels like a peak of sorts when it's only his fourth movie and really his third real one, it seems like. But yeah, Unbreakable is the one that I gravitate toward the most. And it's a great superhero movie too, which is weird. I didn't even mention that, but
yeah, it's a great superhero movie. It is, and there are so many great scenes in that where, like you said, the kind of silence and like the deliberate pacing really, really pay off. I mean, you brought up the fantastic scene in the kitchen with the gun, but there's also the scene where he is doing weightlifting in his basement. And they just continuously are like amazed and shocked at how much he's able to lift, and they just keep adding more weight. And his dynamic with his son is also fantastic. I mean, like, the thinking about it now, like, that is, like, you're correct. It's a peak. It's his most, like, complete and well-constructed movie. Am I hearing some...
Well, we'll get to it.
Okay. Sweet. Danny, what about yourself? What do you think about Unbreakable?
Yeah, I'm similarly positive. I was actually reminded of it a bit while watching Sam Raimi's Darkman the other day. Just in terms of, like, really ingenious, kind of independently thought out superhero films. And yeah, I remember just kind of being more impressed with the atmosphere even than in Sixth Sense. And Nick mentioned some of the directing choices. And so I would say in recollection that that's probably my favorite. I would like, as with Sixth Sense, I'd like to see it again because it has been a while.
All right.
Also, one other thing. There's kind of a funny story behind the ending of that movie where it's a very strange choice he makes where he actually kind of wraps things up with, you know, like screen text.
A coda.
A coda, yeah. What's happened to the people? And I guess I've actually spoken to people who saw Unbreakable, and I've read about this elsewhere, where they saw it and they saw that screen text and they thought that the movie was based on a true story. Like, they just didn't really, just somehow didn't catch word of. Like, it's this amazing, untold true story that is sort of explained by, like, well, now he's in a mental institution and...
Mr. Glass is still out there.
Yeah.
I was going to say there was a documentary, a faux documentary that aired last week called Mermaids. Did anyone hear about this? It was like an Animal Planet / Discovery Channel faux documentary, and it was like a speculative fiction about how mermaids would have evolved and everything. And apparently, like, a lot of people thought it was real. Like, they, because it was billed as like this massive revelation, and like, you know, there's a government cover up and blah blah blah. And a lot of people were like, oh my god, I believe in mermaids. And I was like, what the fuck? So that's just another example of people buying into something. So we're going to talk, I want to talk Signs, and then I think I want to just kind of have a melee for the last four before After Earth. Unless that happens to be one of the movies that you think is the best, Ethan.
Yep, seems like it.
Okay, this is getting bizarre. Now I really want to go through and just one by one figure out which one it is. Signs, Aliens, there was a lot of fanfare for this, and I was excited for it because I was an Aliens nerd when I was a kid.
But you just said you were afraid of being abducted by them beforehand. Like, what?
I know, right? It's so weird. But I think the problem was I wanted to learn as much about them as I could because if I was going to be abducted, I wanted to be prepared, yeah.
Do you watch Ancient Aliens?
I do, but that's more hilarious than anything else.
Yeah, that's a good show.
Nick actually does a pretty good impression of that guy. What is his name?
Giorgio A. Tsoukalos.
That's the one.
I've done an impersonation of him?
Yeah, you did.
Oh, okay. I don't remember that.
You don't remember that?
No.
He was just basically saying, but if you replace like something with aliens, you have a much different story.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Signs.
He reminds me a lot of Stevie from Eastbound and Down.
Oh, Jesus. So Signs comes out. And I think this was the first time that people really got a sense that we were in trouble. I did not mind this film. I do, looking, like, when you look back on it, a lot of the stuff that happens in it is kind of weird, and, you know, the aliens are a little bit strange, considering that they've invaded a planet that's 70% water and they're, like, allergic to it. But still an entertaining film. And again, still with that empathy for the characters that I think buoys a lot of these movies. What was everyone's thoughts on Signs?
Okay, I was going to say, it is, I think, far stronger than a lot of people remember or give it credit for. I think it was probably around that time when the knives started to come out for Shyamalan a bit.
I'd say it was pretty well received.
It was, but...
At least it did really well.
I mean, it did well at the box office, but I think that some of the critical reaction would kind of point toward that was the time when people were kind of ready to go after him a bit. And it's too bad, because I think that it is actually it's not just that it's a very well-crafted movie, it's that it's crafted in a manner I think very different from the likes of his previous features. It's going for a different tone, and it's taking it in this different direction where it is much more about tension. It is much more of a straight-up thriller than The Sixth Sense or Unbreakable. And it's executed, I think, remarkably well. I talked about earlier how in the past he's kind of been guilty of overemphasizing music. And I think that does happen in Signs, but his uses of the James Newton Howard score at certain moments are very, very powerful. Of course, I think of the scene where they have the baby monitor and they're catching an alien signal on it. You know, that's a really, really wonderful sequence. And
that scene terrified me.
And there's
so many parts of this movie that terrified me.
And there's also the scene where Mel Gibson is in the house.
Okay.
He's in the house and he like cuts off the alien's fingers with a knife. Oh. Yeah. These are just, I think, masterclass moments in how you build tension in a scene. And problems notwithstanding, I think that the movie actually is able to overcome them. I mean, yes, I know that the twist in the movie is stupid. Of course it's a stupid twist, but it's still a really
What's even the twist?
That, you know, the water is the...
That's not even really a twist to me.
It's a twist. It is
it's
a twist.
Not because... like, but to me, it's not a twist to the degree that, like, Mr. Glass was the bad guy or Bruce Willis was dead the whole time or they're really living in a...
Yes, yes. But, no, but
guess,
it is...
I'm going to put a spoiler warning, I guess, at the beginning
of this.
It's been out for 10 years.
You know someone is going to be pissed off, so I'm just going to add one in, because I think it's stupid, but I guess right now, thinking about it, I don't know.
Okay.
I just want to cover our ass.
Anyway, I do think it is, because the whole water thing, if you watch it again, the whole water aspect is emphasized pretty heavily. And, yeah, it doesn't make sense that they would invade a planet that is... you know, largely made up of water and the water's atmosphere. But I don't, that's a benefit of this film, is that I don't really care, because I am so with everything else it is doing here in terms of, you know, the formal aesthetics and the acting too. I think that this is one of Mel Gibson's best performances, and Joaquin Phoenix, Ethan, you actually pointed out in your piece for the site that it's kind of a precedent to Mark Wahlberg in The Happening.
It totally is.
Which I like. I kind of like that idea, although I think it is less baffling here, at least. It fits in more clearly.
Well, it's not as good here.
You don't think it's as good as Wahlberg in The Happening?
Ethan, did you really like The Happening?
We'll get to it.
Have I just been, like, thinking that you're joking? Oh, Jesus. Okay.
Oh, he likes The Happening.
This is bananas. I can't wait for this. Okay, so after Signs... Actually, Danny, Signs. What do you thought? What do you think?
Yeah, I also liked Signs. I actually... My perception of it was that it was a very kind of well-regarded film. I don't know if I was just off there, but it seemed like more... when The Village came around that the knives started coming out.
Yeah, that was the first big knives movie.
Yeah, because all my memories of Signs were just, like, me liking it and everyone else I watched it with liking it.
My biggest memory of Signs, and I don't know if I've told you all this story before, but I don't remember any of the critical reaction to Signs. I remember vaguely my own feelings about it, but the thing that sticks out most to me about Signs... are the feelings that two guys who were also in the movie theater with me had about it. because I went and saw this on really like a really obscure day. And so it was my friend Ben and I, and then two other random guys. And as we were leaving the theater, I remember their critical analysis of the film, which was, man, we sat through that whole movie and saw like one alien. I thought there'd be 20, 30 of them spitting shit up, stabbing people. So those guys were disappointed.
Could be used for After Earth, too.
It actually could be, yeah. Oh, God. But yeah, so I can't remember at all what the critical reaction was. I do remember there was a lot of fanfare. Like, the Discovery Channel or something was running, like, nonstop documentaries on crop circles.
Mm. We can talk about M. Night Shyamalan-related documentaries in a minute.
Okay. So let's clump the last four together. The Village, Lady in the Water, The Happening, and The Last Airbender.
Now we're getting there.
Yeah, these are movies that are troubling to a lot of people. And I'd be interested to hear, at first, which of these four films we actually liked. So if you liked one of these films, just throw it out there and let's talk about it.
I love all of them except The Last Airbender.
Are you serious?
Yes.
Wow. Wow. I'm glad I didn't read your piece, because I'm glad I wasn't spoiled on this revelation. What is happening right now?
The twist is that I like them.
The twist is that Ethan likes them all. Okay. Well, that's... I mean... Okay. I did not like, and I will not probably revisit The Village or Lady in the Water, but there were aspects of those films that I actually really liked. And so they were more disappointing for me than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Like, The Village, like, has this great tone, and I loved the music, and it had, like, a great cast of actors. And the actual premise, pre-twist, is fantastic. Like, it would have made for a great kind of morality play, kind of, like, a supernatural thriller, but with really good dramatic human elements. But instead, they just twist it up, and then it just kind of sucks.
I don't see how the twist makes the movie bad in any way.
I actually am going to... I hate to say these words, but I have to agree with Brian.
That was coming.
Yeah, you know, The Village I'm very conflicted on, because it is a beautifully crafted piece of work. Definitely, it has very strong performances from Bryce Dallas Howard in particular, and again, Joaquin Phoenix. Those two knew how to work together. They should do something else. But I do think that the narrative center of the movie is kind of rotten, because I don't think it really amounts to much of any significance or general interest. It kind of feels like Shyamalan having to throw in something twisty and surprising, sort of a narrative gut punch, because that's sort of what's expected of him in a way, which is too bad, because I think that it shows him really growing as a filmmaker and trying out these new things, which I would have liked to have definitely seen more of from him later on, more movies of this accord. But the Village I can't really jibe with, no matter, even though I've tried. I remember rewatching it about a year after on DVD, and I was still very put off by where it goes. I think there's a voice of disagreement that would like to chime in.
No, I want to hear what Danny has to think.
I was going to say, well, we gotta hear Danny. Unless Danny's on Ethan's side, because that would be a bigger twist.
Well, I do like The Village.
Oh, thanks.
Twist and all?
The twist, yeah. I mean, again, I haven't seen it all that recently. But I remember being really impressed by the craft of it. And it did, even years after seeing it, it does kind of just leave this taste in your mouth of being just a really effective movie. Unfortunately, post The Village, I kind of fall off with his work, because I haven't seen any of the following three films. So this is where I kind of pass it off to the master.
All right. So, yeah, Ethan, why don't you tell us about The Village?
Well, I mean, I said this in my little fama website, but it's my favorite of his films, because I think even more so than something like Lady in the Water, which is very blatantly about storytelling, I think this is his film that's most about that, in my opinion. And the idea of, obviously, what you're watching throughout the movie is people trying to enforce a narrative and continue trying to use elements of storytelling. Like I point, this is my favorite thing about the movie. The idea of obviously M. Night Shyamalan, he's very throughout his films, there's very kind of obvious, a very obvious color palette. Yeah. He's very eager to say this, like in the Sixth Sense DVD. Oh, I put red here because it's like it represents danger, right? But in this, I think it's him almost. I think he's very self-aware in this movie. I think about the idea of color, why he uses color, and that he has this belief in it. I think that's what he's revealing. That's what I find is interesting about the movie and the idea that everyone in the movie too, like. This is prevalent in his later movies too, is sort of in an infantile state to a degree. But I like the idea too, it's because they're infantile because they're being manipulated to be that way because a narrative is making them that way. And I think that carries throughout his other movies. So I think it feels like the peak of what he was trying to do with his other movies, which was be about storytelling, be about belief. And to me it's all summed up here, and I agree it's his prettiest looking movie. We should mention it's shot by Roger Deakins, and it's his best sounding movie, scored of course always by James Newton Howard.
And you're fine with the twist?
I have no problem.
I can't.
Though I do think he shouldn't have cameoed as the guy who spells out everything.
Yeah.
That was... Even just the way he shoots himself in that scene is...
I do like the way he shoots himself.
He's reflected on a like a glass door, isn't he?
Yeah. Kind of saying everything in a very kind of sort of exasperated tone, which I actually find funny. I feel like that's sort of winking at the audience a bit, the way he's delivering this twist. But there's a weird, almost like sense of contempt in that scene that I kind of sense, the way he is, you know, speaking directly to the audience, the way he's actually reflected in that scene.
Maybe it's kind of the Norman Bates was of the movie.
Yeah. Little bit to the side. Have you guys ever heard of the original script for the film, The Way It Ended?
No.
It ended with a... it basically ends the same way, but...
Wait, I think does it end with someone saying stupid effing white people?
Yeah, it ends with like a Native American trucker like watching all the stuff going on, like the park ranger talking to the girl and then taking her back, and then someone tells him the story of what goes on. Then he says, "Stupid fucking white people." And then he gets in his truck and he drives away.
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm serious. You can find the script online. It's there. Back when the script was called like The Woods or something. That's how it ended originally, which I kind of wish he kept. But M. Night Shyamalan said it himself.
Holy God.
Unfortunate Son starts playing.
I was going to say, it would be great if right after he says that, it's like a hardcore, like, end of Killing Them Softly, like, just smash cut to black and music. That would be fantastic.
That would do really well on test screenings.
What happened was the script had leaked out, I believe, and then they reshot it because it was... they thought maybe this will get a bad reaction or something.
Oh my God. Shit. Okay. So Lady in the Water came next. This was the one that was marketed as like a bedtime story or like a fairy tale by M. Night Shyamalan. Everyone remember that?
Yeah.
Because I remember pretty much hating the marketing. I was excited for the film though, because again, I was vaguely positive on The Village except for the twist, and I was kind of hoping that this one would do better. I will admit that I have not seen this since I saw it in the theater. But I remember my gut reaction walking out was, I'm done with this guy. just not a fan. Holy shit, guys. This is also his like open attack on film critics. did all of us have the same reaction? Well, okay, obviously Ethan didn't. Ethan, you liked this movie?
Love it.
Okay, Nick. Danny,
yeah,
what about
I've never seen it.
You never saw it?
No.
Okay, so. Then Danny, did you see it?
No.
But, oh my God. All right.
Yeah, but reading about the film critic thing just makes me want to, because that's amazing.
It's pretty funny. I think it's meant to be funny.
It's a ridiculous scene. The whole movie's ridiculous. All this shit just keeps happening.
When people criticize like the acting and the happening, it's like people think that everything in these movies are like a mistake. Like, it's clearly very intentional.
But you can make a choice and still have it be a poor choice.
Yeah, but why is it a poor choice?
I mean, I don't know. Well, we're talking about Lady in the Water. We'll get to the happening in a sec. I kind of almost want to skip over The Last Airbender. So, Lady in the Water, you liked this film. Were there what aspects would you like to highlight?
Well, I mean, it's not. I find it very touching. In a way. I find all his films very touching because I think it's a movie. It's a movie that's very exaggerated in, to every degree, but at the same time, to me, it's very, like I said, like with The Village, it's very earnest in kind of talking about storytelling and in the way that, like, I'm talking about the exaggeration here, like every character in the movie who lives in that apartment complex is a complete caricature, for example.
Right, like the guy who was only exercising one arm.
One arm, or like the hippies, or like the obnoxious Asian ladies and whatnot. It was like, naff! But,
Wait, do that again.
No, I don't take requests.
All right, I'm just going to copy and paste that throughout the podcast.
Okay.
It's going to be randomly you screaming, naff!
But it's interesting because I watched the movie again like about a month or so, maybe a little more, with my roommates. And every time, for example, there's also the scene where Paul Giamatti, he's being read a bedtime story and he curls up on the couch with milk and cookies. He has like a milk mustache and everything. And like my roommates were like laughing. This is so stupid. This is so stupid. I'm just sort of thinking to myself, oh, I don't know, why is this stupid? Like, it's fine. I can just take that at face value. And I think that's what's interesting about the movie is how, I don't know if this was intentional necessarily, but I think the movie holds up a mirror to the viewer in saying, okay, to what degree, what do you take seriously? What do you take at face value? Why do you laugh at something? In a way, I think it's a movie, to me, very free of cynicism, which is why I like it.
Okay. I don't remember this movie well enough to try to negate any of that. So,
and it looks, and again, it looks beautiful. It's shot by Christopher Doyle. And
I don't remember liking it that much. Like, my recollection of it is this kind of like dark blacks and teal.
I think the teals and the blues are beautiful looking, but
okay. Maybe I'll have to go back and watch it.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know where I'd find it because I sure as shit ain't buying it, but all right, so I have not seen The Happening, even though I remember I was actually very excited for the movie because they did a really good job with the marketing campaign of like all the different people committing suicide and like this sense of dread. But then I started to hear shit about it, and I was just like, you know what? My life is too short. But Ethan, you say that you like The Happening.
It's my second favorite of his films.
I'm concerned that people on the internet are going to think that we're trolling them. I would like you to tell us about The Happening and what makes it your second favorite of his films.
Just out of curiosity, I guess, Danny, you haven't seen it. Nick, have you seen it?
Yes, I have.
Okay, well, I'll also get into it first. But what I like about it is that, I said this in my article, but it's him, again, being very earnest about kind of emotional versus rational reasoning. And he does that in making his characters, at least his essential two, played by Mark Wahlberg and Zooey Deschanel, the most infantile, like immature, like strange characters I've ever seen in any movie, maybe ever. And he's putting them in a situation throughout where basically there's this idea where you can try to, it's even mentioned in the classroom scene in the film, where you can try and explain something using science, using math, using all these equations. But then there's things where you can only kind of escape something through emotion, really. And that's why I like the movie. I think it's very earnest about that. And even there's a scene a lot of people make fun of in the movie where Mark Wahlberg's in the field and everyone's shooting themselves. And everyone's like, do something. And there's this close up on Wahlberg's face as he's just making these series of weird faces, being like, okay, well, the variables, you know, when you do this, I'm thinking. And I like that scene because it exemplifies perfectly the entire idea of the movie, which is someone trying to kind of hide behind rationality, math, science, when really the solution to that problem is just to operate on instinct, on emotion, and save the people. I really like the movie a lot for stuff like that.
All right, Nick, what about you?
Well, that's a valid, it's a fascinating interpretation, but I have to admit, I don't understand The Happening at all. The movie is, I just think, is absolutely baffling. And I just really don't know what he was trying to do. And I think that, while I do like that assessment of it, I don't know. It strikes me as maybe a little, the movie itself strikes me as a little misguided, a little miscalculated. And I think that part of the problem is that it is such a unique, specific movie that it has to be calibrated perfectly in order to be able to actually pull off. And I don't think it is. I think that it's kind of trying to balance too much of the sort of the B movie tone and elements with a genuine horror, which he tries to communicate. You know, there's a lot of shots of people killing themselves. That I think what's supposed to be like a showstopper sequence is when there's a gun on the ground and people keep picking up and shooting themselves. But the scene just rings to me as silly, and I don't think it really works at all. I'm not sure how much of that is dependent upon tone and also his handling of it, the way it's shot. But the film itself, I kind of can't really jibe with. I don't think it's, you know, I mean, I talk about how with Signs there were critics who had their knives out. I mean, this is definitely another example of that. The movie is not, it's not the worst film ever made, but, and I think in part because of that, it's because, yeah, he clearly is going for humor at certain points, but there are other scenes that I just don't understand at all. I mean,
one of my favorite scenes, and I don't even quite understand this, is when, you know, there's a guy who talks about hot dogs.
I was about to say.
But there's that scene too, he asks Zooey Deschanel if she likes hot dogs, and it cuts her and she just mouths, no. It's one of the weirdest.
or the old woman with the shotgun, which is, I mean, there's the kid who gets shot in the chest, which I actually found very funny, but I'm not sure if it is meant to be comedic, because it's played in slow motion and, you know, Mark Wahlberg is running towards him and shouting his name and trying to save him, but he just gets killed. And it's this really bloody, graphic death. And it's playing with so many tones at once. And I do like that aspect of it, but I don't know what I don't know how I'm supposed to feel at that moment, because I don't think the movie is scary at all, because it's such a stupid idea, like something that would just probably never happen. I don't want to say never, because, you know, who knows, but...
Because won't, I mean, you have egg on your face when everyone starts killing themselves.
I mean, Brian, you know the twist of it, right? But it's the
wind and the trees and...
It's
again,
plants.
To me, that's not... To me, that's not really a twist.
I mean, I figured that's what was happening when I even just saw the trailers, and I had no problem with that. Like, the idea of an event of, like, the environment that, like, causes people to kill themselves, that's fine. Like, plants can do weird shit like that to insects, so it's an interesting idea that, like, the planet would evolve to destroy us. That'd be cool. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Kind of culling the herd. But, I mean... From the way it was executed, I heard, I didn't want to.
Well, I mean, there's a scene in the movie where characters run from wind, which I think, it's so absurd. I feel like Shyamalan must be aware of, you know, of it in and of itself. But, I mean, it's also problematic when that was played as a joke on South Park, too. So I don't know. I don't think that The Happening I don't think it's as bad as a lot of people will claim or would sort of like the film to be, but I don't get it. I'm going to have to punt on it a bit. I really don't understand
that. I've seen it three times, and it gets better every time.
All right.
I'm just floored
re-watch.
By the fact that you're saying this.
Well, I mean,
all right.
Was the last Airbender.
Has anyone seen
it? I'll say it wasn't as bad as I remembered. It's bad, but
okay.
At least I'll say this. I think at least it looks nice. I think the action sequences are quite good. But to me, what I don't like about it is that, to me, just after a string of such risky movies, it feels so like...
It was him like trying to latch onto a franchise to...
It's funny too, because there's this famous, it's on YouTube, but I think it's Shyamalan, he's at a press conference in Mexico, and someone asks him basically that question, were you after, you know, a string of not so successful movies where you're trying to do something kind of safe. And he gives this awesome answer. He's like, if I had that, if I operate under that thinking, I would kill myself. And he gives this huge long answer. It's awesome. It's awesome seeing him just shut down this person. But at the same time, deep down, I kind of think, yeah, you were.
You totally did, bro.
Yeah, I also think The Last Airbender is, from my memory of it, it's been a couple of years, but that film is inept in ways that professionally made movies should not be inept. They're just very basic errors that he makes as a filmmaker. The way he shoots certain sequences and edits them too. I mean, Ethan, you rewatched it recently, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you recall there's a scene where the main character is having a conversation where he's like explaining the massacre of a village or something, and the camera holds on his face for this really strange kind of like editing rhythm where it's kind of focusing on him when it clearly should not be focusing on him because there are other characters speaking. I don't know if you know exactly what I'm talking about or not.
At least I didn't notice it.
I mean, it was something that I had watched the film and it struck me as especially odd. And it was, there are a lot of things in the film like that. There are moments where there's one scene that involves a rock levitation where he, you know, probably should have been racking the camera a bit to kind of give the scene a little more flow, and he just doesn't.
I still think, I still think the action is very well shot. Like, it's very classical.
Yeah, it is well shot, and some of the effects are kind of neat, but I don't think it's thrilling at all. Partially because I just don't really care. But I guess that's not really a fault of the.
I think kind of an inherent problem too is something just happens when you're adapting a cartoon, when it's okay to have like a 10-year-old kid as your main character who's doing action when he's, you know, like a cartoon. But you have to actually cast an actual 10-year-old who can hold a movie like this, yeah, who can be the center and do action. It's just, you know, you can't realistically find any 10-year-old who can do that.
Yes.
But again,
not that old either.
Yeah. Again, yeah, not as bad as I remembered. Because I was really dreading rewatching it. Because I probably disliked it as much as you did when I first saw it. But
all right. Well, that is our entire career retrospective on M. Night Shyamalan. This has become the longest discussion we've ever done. So let's get into his newest film, After Earth, in theaters this weekend, starring Jaden and Will Smith. And this movie, apparently M. Night Shyamalan co-wrote it with Gary Whitta, but it was also based on an idea by Will Smith. Am I having that correct?
Yeah, I believe the script was originally written by Gary Whitta, and then M. Night Shyamalan did some work on it. And then actually, of all people, Stephen Gaghan, who did Syriana and Traffic, did some rewrite work on the movie.
I read, too, that Mark Boll did rewrite work on it, so I had like Oscar winners.
Yeah,
all right.
That's strange.
Interesting. All right, well, yeah, let's talk about After Earth.
Crash landed. Two confirmed survivors. Son, this is not training. This is a class one quarantined planet. The threats we will be facing are real. Everything on this planet has evolved to kill humans.
So, After Earth is the story of a post-Earth society and the crash landing that strands father and son on the surface of the nature-reclaimed planet Earth. It's dangerous, the father is injured, and the son has to travel 100 kilometers overland in order to get the beacon, a beacon that's going to be able to save them. What did we think of After Earth? Danny, we haven't heard from you a lot, so I'd like you to kick us off.
Oh, my pleasure.
I'm so glad you're amenable.
Yes, yes. I think I'm mostly positive on After Earth. It did it did take me a while to like it because that opening, I think we discussed this a little bit before the recording. The opening is really bad, and it's almost like Oblivion Syndrome, where you just have this voiceover explaining this future world, and there are these terrible insert shots of like energy problems and stuff like that, and it's just like, oh my god. But then it kind of gets going, and even some of the early family scenes are a little off, but I think I started to really like the film after they crashed. And there's a scene between Will Smith and the kid, and there was an interaction I really liked where Will Smith just kind of right off the bat is just like, yeah, both of my legs are broken. You have to get this beacon or we're going to die. And I was just like, I was kind of shocked by how serious the movie was. And it kind of kept that pitch throughout of just this like very dour movie about kind of physical trauma and kind of just this like danger that I liked. I was also kind of just stunned throughout the movie that someone was willing to give $130 million to make this movie, because it clearly seemed to me like something that an average person wouldn't want to spend their Friday night seeing, because it's really one note. And I think the kid has some scenes that aren't acted particularly well. I think that's part of why I like it. It has this like interest factor where it feels like it could have been made for maybe $50 million, because it's kind of like a minimalist world in some ways. But overall, I would say I really kind of liked the seriousness of it more than anything else. And so I probably liked it more than I was expecting to.
All right. And Ethan, what about yourself? As our resident M. Night Shyamalan defender.
As Danny mentioned, the beginning had me a little worried too, because I'd say the first 15 to 20 minutes, as well as, I mean, just the little expository VO and whatnot, it's just very geeky.
It's a bizarre choice, I'll
it's
say
just
this.
So like, it's like just so like Rangers, ghosting, like just all this like all these
planets.
Like rules and this backstory and this geeky, it's like it felt like a bad like kids book or something.
Yeah,
but the thing is, again, once they crash, you kind of gradually remove those elements more and more. And what I think about this film is that I like it. I don't think it's overall 100% successful, though, because I think the version of this movie I want to see is the Tropical Malady, Aguri, the Wrath of God version. But instead, it sort of still ends up being the kind of CGI blockbuster, because I think they shot this, I think it was Hawaii they shot it in? I could be wrong.
Not Philadelphia.
But was born and raised in the Will's from Philadelphia. Yeah, man, they must have got along on the set so well. But
talking about Philadelphia a lot.
It's all like, it's a very, to me, it feels like a very naturalist, just very naturalism. There's a lot of naturalism in this movie, and just the location, and that there's even these scenes where just Jane is like on a raft and whatnot, and he's going through this, and you're hearing sound of nature, and you're like, this is like, yeah, this is very atmospheric, this is very moody. But then there's also too these issues where, okay, you have this really great setting, but then there's a bunch of CGI monkeys
or yeah.
CGI birds or whatnot. And it sort of – it takes away from this naturalism. And two, I think even to me, the climax of the movie, which is Jaden fighting a giant monster. I don't know if that's a spoiler or not.
I don't believe it's a spoiler. No. There are some things that could, I guess, be construed as spoilers, but I don't believe that a climactic battle between the very obviously set up climactic boss – to use video game parlance is one of them.
I think that, again, the version of this movie that I think would be the best version of it would not end in that. It would either end in him fighting a very real tiger, or even there's this idea in the movie of, you know, conquering fear and whatnot, right? Or I think it would be interesting if it almost subverted that slightly in the idea of conquering fear not being about killing a CGI monster, but being about avoiding violence. Because I think in a way there's almost a very kind of humane treatment of nature throughout this movie.
Yeah, there is, even,
there's a dying like CGI bird, which I actually think he treats very respectfully, which he doesn't need to, but he does.
Do you want to raise your comparison?
Again, he treats that with more care and humanism than Michael Haneke did Emmanuel Riva in Amour.
Oh, for the love of God.
But,
whoa.
But, yeah, I mean, I still think the movie is, to me, it's good. Like, it feels assured to a degree. And again, it's 12% on Rotten Tomatoes. Just to investigate things a little. I last night I watched the higher rated on Rotten Tomatoes, Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters.
Okay, I have not seen that.
Or even like just thinking of like A Good Day to Die Hard, which is rated higher. I don't know. I'm baffled. Why this is being shit on so much?
All right, Nick. What about yourself?
I think I'm going to continue the sort of moderately positive reaction, which is to say, I don't know if I really like this movie that much, but I think it's about a third good, and then another third, sort of okay. So yes, there is a bad, third in there, but the movie I will agree that the opening of the film is really dreadful, and I was concerned about the next 100 minutes. I did laugh when it was the shot of like Will Smith like walking in slow motion, cutting the creature with a sword, and then just kind of continuing to walk.
Especially since the creature was very obviously still alive.
Yeah, there was an absolute ridiculousness there that I like in my science fiction, frankly. It was absurd. It was even laughable, but I think, better to be laughable in that way than just kind of dull, which I think is a trap the movie falls into, because once he kind of is out on his own, there's a repetitiveness to it, sort of the encounters that he has. They don't really feel all that varied, or even it doesn't even feel like there's that much danger in the movie, to be honest.
Not. They make a big deal about everything on this world has evolved to kill humans, but it's like,
right, and he just kind of runs away from a large group of like wild baboons, like overgrown baboons, and I was kind of looking forward to seeing a conflict there, but it doesn't feel like there's much in the way of character growth. And that's kind of what the whole film is about. And yeah. I think the movie actually does a decent job of creating an arc for Katai, as his name is. So anyway, I think that, and then I also talked about before Shyamalan's love of silence, and that's in this movie, but I don't think it really works for the blockbuster template. It was a problem in The Last Airbender too, where it's awkwardly quiet. It really should not be that quiet.
There's still a lot of there are a lot of scenes in this movie that have no music at all.
Well, that's exactly what I'm referring to.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
The prime example is the dinner sequence with Katai and Cypher and the mother whose name I can't remember.
Baya?
Is something like that.
I'm looking at it. That's what it is.
Oh, okay. that use, I understand what he's going for, and I appreciate his attempts to deliver that, but it doesn't really surface, I guess.
I like it a lot in the flashbacks, actually.
The lack of music?
Yeah.
Did you?
Okay. It reminds me a lot of Before Midnight in that way.
Well... and then there are also certain other aesthetic choices I couldn't really jibe with. There's a strange first-person POV shot at one point.
Oh, yeah.
When you're not expecting it to be one.
Yeah.
I was with somebody, and they whispered, "What the fuck?" at that moment, which kind of summarized my own feelings there. I'm saying all these things, and they're actually points of interest for the movie, even if they are flaws. I find so many modern blockbusters to be just kind of boring nowadays, and this movie, even though it is kind of boring too, it's at least boring in interesting ways, I guess. if it's not succeeding, at least it's going for something a little outside the box. And yeah, I agree. The movie's critical reception is ridiculous, and I am calling out critics on it.
I was going to say that. Yeah. I mean, I think I'm probably going to be the least positive person on this movie, but I'm still far from being entirely negative. My main problem with the movie is that it sets up such an interesting and complex world and then strands us on basically a jungle.
Well,
with these two guys.
Like I said, I was very happy to get away from that interesting and complex world.
Well, okay, first of all, it's an interesting and complex world that I don't think I'd want to spend a lot of time on. But here's the thing. So the movie is boring from time to time, and there's not even a lot of action set pieces. Like, it is just a lot of this kid running the fuck away. And that causes a problem because, like, his agency is cut, like, in half. But, so they crash land on this planet, and their plane, their spaceship, is carrying an Ursa, which is this creature that apparently is a biological weapon created by another spacefaring alien race to wipe out humans. But the politics or the motivation of that other alien race is completely abandoned. There's no reason for there to be another sentient spacefaring race. They very well could have just been a wild animal on their homeworld.
Yeah, I mean, again, another reason why I said I wish the climax of this movie was a real tiger.
Yeah.
As opposed to a giant CGI monster.
Space grub with many arms. But this is indicative of a lot of the problems I have with this movie. There are story choices that make no sense. Like I said, there's an entire other spacefaring alien race that we never see, but that bred a creature for the sole purpose of killing humans, and their genius masterstroke is to make the creature blind, but to make it be able to smell fear pheromones. Like, why don't you just give it some eyes? Why don't you give it, like, infrared heat-sensing pits like a snake? You could do a lot of things, and fear pheromones feels like just the most obvious thematic choice that could possibly be made. And it doesn't have any real purpose. Like, no one would ever be like, okay, I want to kill bears. I need a creature that can kill bears. Maybe I should find, like, a creature and make it that doesn't have any eyes or any other way to sense something than, like, pheromones. Like, this doesn't make any sense. But you know what? I'll get past it. But, I mean, even the setting of a post-human Earth is never exploited to its fullest degree. Like, it's not like they decide that they're going to come back, and like, because this child has like shown them that like with respect and, you know, stewardship, they can find a new place. Like they, when the movie's called After Earth, and I think you could have subbed in literally any alien planet for this place, and there would have been no thematic or narrative difference. Like, that's a problem. And these are only things that really stood out to me because the movie itself is so boring that I didn't have any choice. I was also really hung up on the accents.
Yeah.
It's just like a weird choice. Like, I get it. You know, it's the future, and not everyone can be talking like Patrick Stewart in Star Trek The Next Generation. But, like, the choice made to make their voices like that is bizarre.
Should we describe it?
Can you?
I mean, we use the word Cajun.
Yeah.
Before we were recording, and that's sort of it. It's, you know, suffrage. Kata. It's it's just very distracting, partially because the lines when they're spoken by Will Smith has a very recognizable voice. Like you can just hear a recording of him speaking and know immediately that it is Will Smith. And and so the decision to alter it like so without any clear motivation is going to be a distraction. No matter how good the film ends up being, it will be a distraction, particularly if you don't provide some sort of context. And the movie doesn't. And it's, you know, I do like in science fiction films, in future set science fiction films that have a certain uniqueness, a little an alteration to the real world that's kind of not explained. But I think that it is a piece of, you know, quote unquote world building that I like, but there is a point where I think you have to kind of, where you'll have to explain it a bit. And the characters' voices is one, because it's just how they're just speaking in this strange tone and kind of also this stilted manner too.
I was about to say, like, there were scenes where I was not sure if they were making an actorly choice, like, my character feels nothing and therefore is terrible at telling stories.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a sequence early on when they're on the ship before it crashes, and Katai says to Cypher Rage, he says, oh, by the way, the character's name is Cypher Rage, which
but
is...
They, but because but the of thing the is, bizarre yes, accents.
But because of the accents, it's, you know, Cypher Rage.
Cypher Rage.
So that's kind of a wise choice. But there's a scene where Katai is talking to him, and he says, I've started reading Moby Dick, and his father stares at him again, no music, it's silent. His father stares at him for about 3 or 4 seconds. He nods his head and goes, yes, mother told me. It's good. And then he kind of like goes back to looking at his futuristic iPad, what have you.
Which is awful because it's not rigid, so it's just flopping in his hands. Like, that's bad usability.
Yeah, but anyway. It's a... I just don't know. It kind of goes back to what I said about The Happening, where I said that movie just kind of defeats me in a lot of ways, and I really don't understand it. That's how I felt about a lot of this movie here. And I don't know if maybe I'm not onto Ethan's flow, and he's a secret genius who is confounding audiences through these choices to some greater effect. But yeah, it is things like that, which I know I'm getting too hung up on it, but it is...
Well, I mean, in this case, when you have kind of a second auteur, which is Will Smith, I mean, a lot of these choices, I can imagine Will Smith being like, yeah, they got to have accents. This is really going to add to my character.
I mean, that's true, but also because, you know, I mean, Shyamalan was probably a yes man. Or sorry, he was probably answering to a yes man. Or no, was he a... Is that how it works? What is a yes man? Yes.
A yes man is a guy who just says yes.
Yes, exactly. So I think that he was at the mercy of Smith as a producer here, but it does feel like a choice he probably would make otherwise. So I can't argue against it. And it speaks to a larger problem where the movie...
No, I think if it was a choice he made, Will Smith would be talking about the time he met Jaden at the pharmacy.
What?
Remember that scene in The Happening when Mark Wahlberg's like, man, I went to the pharmacy, man, really good looking teller behind the bank, but you know what? You know who it was? It was you. And he makes this face.
Yeah, that's right. Now I remember.
I do not. Well, I never saw that movie.
You clearly have to see it.
I was going to say, you're talking about world building and we're hung up on the accents, but like also the production design in this movie is outright crazy and unthinkable.
I was going to say the inside of the spaceship looked like it was like made of bones or something.
I kept saying to people it's like a Pier 1 Imports like patio gazebo. Mm-hmm. Like it's all lashed together. I mean, I was first put off by this when Jaden has to go into the commander's office to like see if he's going to become a ranger. And this is the commander's played by Glenn Morshower, who is
great character actor.
Yeah, he's fantastic. He's been in a lot of stuff, and I loved him in 24, where he was Agent Aaron Pierce.
Yeah,
the only like truly honorable and good man in that entire series. Like,
yeah, that's a good point. Yeah,
he's the unsung hero of the 24 series. But that's when I first really noticed the accent, because you know I might just not know what Jaden sounds like now. Like maybe he just has that accent. But when Glenn Morshower, who I have seen in more things than I can count, and who has one of the more recognizable voices,
yeah.
And he's sounding weird. I'm like, what the fuck is happening?
Which is weird because he has a southern accent in real life. So you can kind of,
you could just
keep him.
That. Yeah, you know? But so, like, to get into the office, Kitai, who's Jaden's character, has to step, like, diagonally between these, like, sheets that are strung up that don't cover floor to ceiling, but are like lashed maybe a foot or 6 inches between floor and ceiling. And I realized that like that was like a doorway, and that is a doorway between almost every part of a house. And that's not only the doorway, but like also the coverings on the windows of these places. And I'm just like, well, someone has to explain that to me. Someone has to be like, we can't have doors because these, like, sheets that we've hung are so much better. And it's like, they have to, like, Will Smith, when he's leaving Katai's room, has to, like, do a little jig sidestep to actually get through. And I think Katai actually, like, just runs into them every once in a while. Because they're just a sheet, so he can just easily brush it out of the way. And I'm just like, there's got to be a reason for this, right? And the mother even appears to be, like, moving them at some point. It's like she's setting up where the sheets should go on the outside of this building they're living in. But that doesn't ever come to anything. And that's just this kind of bizarre world building. And later on in the movie, there's, like, a doorway that's just covered by, like, a straw thatch.
Like, that was actually, yeah. I noticed that. That was pretty neat when they first crashed, and I was like, what is this?
Oh, no, you're thinking of the kind of, like, membranous, right? Like, the thing that kept retracting and expanding.
Yeah, that's what...
That was interesting, but what I'm talking about is when he first enters the room with the cage, and he's just like, I'm going to push this, like, matted straw, like, blind out of the way. And there's even a hole cut through the matted straw so that, like, a pipe can go through. And these are bizarre choices that don't make any sense to me. And I need someone to be like, you know, we have a very limited supply of metals, and therefore we can only use fibrous materials.
I mean, I can't say this, but I'm very happy that we're like 15 minutes into the movie. This is like not an issue.
I like the lack of explanation.
I think Shyamalan is actually great with pacing. Because all of his films are very slow, deliberately paced, but to me, they still always feel to me like very kind of laser focused, very structurally intact. And I think this is another case of that where he knows, okay, we need about 15 minutes to set this up. Then, boom. I think again, it could have lingered on that stuff so much longer, and I'm so glad it didn't.
But it really bugged me. Like, it bugged me that they don't apparently have guns. Like, they have this thing called the Cutlass, which in fairness is a pretty cool little thing. It's like it reminds me of those things that you could get as a kid from, like, Spencer's, where it's just like a bunch of needles and then you press your hand into it and you can make shapes. But in this form, the shapes, like, can kill things. And it's an interesting idea, but, like, they apparently don't have guns. And they have, like, this thatchwork inside of a spaceship, but they also have, like, holographic abilities. And the thing that bothered me most, I think, though, is that all of their, like, consoles, like, in a movie where, like, if someone were to open, like, a wall console and pull out a med kit, like, instead of being a door with a latch, it's just this flap of plastic.
Okay, I'm going to stop you right here.
Mm-hmm.
It's cool that you have all these issues, but can we talk about something else?
Well, no, because I was going to say that the reason that that's an issue for me is because, like, half of the problems that happen in this movie are because of that flap of plastic and the fact that it doesn't do anything. And it's just, it's a thing that bothered me throughout the entire movie, because you've set up this world that, and like I said earlier, it seems so interesting, and I want to know the answers to these things, but then you just strand two characters on a barren jungle world that just happens to be Earth, but that doesn't have anything to do with anything.
Well, again, because it's supposed to be a contrast. It's supposed to be one world where it's like all these sci-fi gadgets and rules and things like ghosting and Earth and accents. And then you drop someone on a very naturalistic place, just something that's very barren, where all you can operate under is emotion, not gadgetry, not... it's flying. Well, I guess there's flying squirrel suits he still uses. but that's the entire point. And that's why I kind of wish the movie, like I said, I wish the movie used just its setting a little more, because then you'd have an even clearer contrast between the geekiest of geeky sci-fi and just a very naturalistic jungle movie, basically.
But all the things I was talking about, all the production design issues, like, you should use production design to tell a story, and I don't... It only confuses me when everything seems to have no real utilitarian purpose to this society that's, like, very based on the issues of survivalism and, like, making it on this barren world that's now covered with these Ursas. Like, there's just something about that. And, like, their system for strapping into this spaceship, and like their safety harnesses are just like two straps that would like not pass muster in a Ford Focus. Like it, you're causing me problems as a viewer trying to understand the world that you're living in when you don't bring that stuff up.
I think the whole movie should have just been steampunk.
I mean, that would have been cool.
There were other aspects of this movie which it speaks to my whole reaction, where I appreciated their application, but I don't think it worked. One is it's a very long shot of Will Smith kind of staring ahead at the camera, telling his son a story.
Oh yeah,
which is very uncomfortable.
It was so pretty.
Yes, exactly. It just does not add up at all. The sort of that equation of choice and execution and sort of its place in the entire film. And
a choice, it is, just like fear.
Yes. I was very kind of, it was what was most troubling about the movie was pieces like that, which I'd like to see more of. I'd like to see more of that patient gaze in my blockbusters. I mean, you know, 2 weeks ago we talked about Star Trek, which I basically liked, but the movie is so manic that you almost can't breathe sometimes when you're watching it. Right. This movie maybe takes too much time to breathe, but I think it goes without saying that that's preferable, really. Right. And I don't know. I mean, I wonder if the reaction to the movie, again, there is also the M. Night hate, which is impacting it a lot. And
then the accusations of Scientology propaganda.
Well, I think, I kind of feel like the reason this is being so trashed is the Will and Jaden factor more.
There's a lot. There's the idea of like nepotism. Then there's the idea of, you know, oh, it's another M. Night Shyamalan. And then layered onto that is the new Scientology propaganda claim.
Yeah, which is an interesting claim, but I don't know if it's entirely.
I don't know enough about Scientology to know if it's possibly true.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it adds up too strongly.
I do think that it's a weird message in a film.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, at some point the mother's like, you know, he's a feeling boy, and I'm like, you know, oh, maybe like there's gonna be something else. Like maybe instead of, you know, maybe instead of fear, you should find like empathy. Or
it's interesting though. There's that line at the end of the movie. I don't know if this is a spoiler, where he's like, "I want to work with mom."
Yeah.
I mean, I like how basically the last sounds of this movie are Will Smith chuckling to himself in his weird accent. Where he goes, it felt like a really appropriate note to end the movie on.
Yeah.
Kind of like M. Night just saying, you know, that's how I'm going to do it. Kind of. It's very, very aware of, that's the thing. I think M. Night is sort of, well, I don't know, actually. I'm not sure if he's aware of the movie's absurdity. I can't figure this fucking guy out, ever.
Well, that's what I like about this. This is what I like about all his movies. They're very earnest. They have conviction. And I think even to the most ridiculous things in this movie, he treats them that way.
Right. Well, do you think The Happening is earnest with its pharmacist?
I think that, it's meant to be funny.
Yeah.
But I think in terms of, I don't think he's making fun of the character in that scene.
Okay. All right. Now I really want to rewatch The Happening.
I want to just see The Happening.
Actually, I wanted to mention this about this. I think there were a lot of effective horror moments in this, where you could tell he's a horror film. There's some actually kind of violent, gory scene. There's one of my favorite images in the movie is all the rangers impaled on that
tree. That reminded me of a scene in Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy.
Yeah, or all the dead baboons, or even I think the scene where Jane first goes into the cave to confront the monster, I think is very suspenseful. So I think you can still see a very talented kind of horror thriller director in this, even though it's, again, a big sci-fi blockbuster.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, it's effectively directed. The action scenes are competent and easy to follow. There's just so many story elements, and so
just
story,
that that magical tarp didn't have enough metal filings.
It just doesn't make sense. Like, why would any society ever evolve to have that be the way to do it? And it's a sci-fi film, and like I should be getting stuff from that. And like, it's not movie breaking. Like, I'm still vaguely positive on this film. But what I'm saying is that you've set up a world that I wanted to learn more about. Because I'm not saying
read the Italian graphic novel.
I don't know. That's not my thing, man.
That's why Will Smith is setting up a whole... have you read the IMDb trivia page for this? It's like, Will Smith plans to have, like, tie-in graphic novels, websites, like, web comics explaining the entire backstory of this world.
Oh, God, I don't care.
So I think finally the questions will be answered.
Well, I think the movie does feel not necessarily narratively incomplete, because it is a pretty kind of open and shut story, but... Yeah, the world building feels very confused confused in the context of this movie. Maybe it is mapped out but I don't care. I don't want to have to read a children's tie-in novel to understand Afterbirth.
Yeah, but here's the thing again. I really can't stress this enough. This story feels perfunctory to its own world.
By which you mean
their survival means nothing to the survival of other people on their planet, and that's fine. Like, I get it's a father-son story, but we keep seemingly forgetting that there's a spacefaring race of aliens capable of biologically engineering a new organism that's trying to kill humanity.
Yeah, but I mean, it's barely established, so you can just kind of
you can't just I know it's barely established, and that might be like but it doesn't that feel weird to anyone? Danny, back me up.
We have enough movies out there about saving the universe.
But it doesn't need to be saving the universe. It would just be nice if I just need like three more lines of dialogue about that.
What makes you think Cypher is not going to stop it?
Well, now that Cypher Rage is alive, like the next movie is going to be like
and Katai
after Moon.
After Moon. Oh, God.
After Midnight.
Oh, Jesus. Okay.
Anyway, I guess I'll maybe, unrelated to the movie, but related to M. Night Shyamalan, maybe this is a good thing to end on. What do you think is next for him?
He's already said, kind of.
Did he?
Yeah, he said he's writing a very small drama about forgiveness in a family or something.
I think that's exactly what he should do. I think he should stick to kind of like, very small, like almost independent films.
Yeah, and he's also he's doing that thing now where he talks up the Unbreakable sequel, which
it won't happen.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to see him attempt it, but I don't think it'll.
I feel like it's been too long. Like Bruce Willis is not the same man he used to be,
and I don't think the movie has quite the. I don't think it's quite as well regarded as we might hold it.
And to me, it's a complete story.
It is.
Yeah.
It would have been interesting to see that continue, but I feel
especially
like...
with the text on the screen wrapping it up. So.
Oh, dear. Do we need to do spoilers for this?
I feel like we already kind of did.
I don't quite understand the bird, but I guess that's unimportant.
I thought it was kind of a... I think it's a sign of poor character development when suddenly Katai cares about the bird eggs or something.
Well, because I actually got that because he's an empathetic kid. Like,
yeah,
as the mother said, he's a feeling boy. Like, those are little chicks.
He just seemed to care too much when he should, he should probably be more concerned.
Well, I think he saw himself in the chicks and he saw his dad in the giant.
I actually agree with that. Like that.
Oh, really?
I thought that was a well done scene. Like.
No, it's a fine scene, but
I should say something positive about this film. So yeah, I like that scene because I am positive on the film. I wouldn't vehemently.
You just wish they explained the costumes more.
Not the costume. The costume made a lot of sense to me. The life suit makes sense. Like, though that was a really weird line where it's like my suit turned black. I like it, but I think it's a bad thing.
I actually thought I was like I made that up or something in my mind. It's like no, I didn't say that.
I actually think we've talked about how he has a love of certain color emphasis in his movies. I thought that was actually a pretty good way to incorporate it into
the suit changing color.
This movie. Yeah, I mean, no, it's
I like that.
It's more obvious, and it is more connected to the story itself. But it was a nice little auteur touch.
Yeah, but also that suit is good world building. Like, these people have the ability to create this suit that's kind of like a chameleon suit, or like it forms as its own sense of a warning system.
Mm.
Like, that I get behind. Every other choice is kind of crazy to me, and I've
also
been forced to linger on it.
What was with take a knee? Was that not did I miss something? Was that
take
not
a knee? I think is just like, it's a way to kind of ground you. I mean, like,
yeah.
I kind of knew it because I used to be on like baseball and soccer teams, and so it'd be like take a knee. Like, take a knee is like, calm the hell down, like, focus, and we're gonna talk about some shit.
Yeah,
if you're up and wandering around, you're scanning and you're looking for things, and
right. I just think this movie has a problem with exposition and explanation, where it either explains far too much or explains enough. Far too little. There's no proper balance there, and
exactly.
That's just it's a small thing, but it is a thing nevertheless. So
yeah. There you go. I was gonna say after
explored
Earth,
this film,
we're all vaguely positive on it.
I mean, you know, it's a C+ film.
I was gonna say it's a C+. It's not. It's definitely not something that I would tell people to stay away from. Like the last couple films we've talked about. I mean, like, it has its moments, and like I said, the direction's good, and especially like Ethan brought up, that cave scene towards the end. Is effective horror beats. Like, I was actually legitimately concerned.
Mm.
So there's effective points like that.
To be fair, one of the last films we talked about that you said people should avoid is Francis Ha, which is a wonderful movie.
I don't believe that. Now, I didn't listen to it again, but I don't think I told people effectively to stay away. But I said that I didn't like it.
Okay, all right.
Did you respond to the comment?
I responded really, really long to the comment. In fact, did he ever respond back?
I don't know.
I was going to give him a shout out and tell him to check it out, but I feel like he just doesn't care. that was aggravating. He made me sound like a father from an 80s movie, like an overbearing. Mm. Anyway, so After Earth, in theaters now. Check it out if you feel the need. But let's move on and let's talk about the movies coming to DVD and Blu-ray. DVD and Blu-ray, June 4th. We're going to move through this really fast. So, yeah. Good Day to Die Hard. Warm Bodies. Midway, The Shadow. Identity Thief. And some other re-releases happening here and there. Anyone have any of these that they would like to bring to the fore?
Don't watch Good Day to Die Hard.
I'm going to have to see it at some point.
Are you?
I mean, you know, I want to see Die Hard. Even if it's bad, I feel like I should see it. Because I'm sort of... like, I've seen all the other ones, so... anyway. I won't even watch
Lady in the Water.
All right. Some Universal horror is getting released on Blu-ray. The Mummy, Phantom of the Opera, and The Invisible Man. Which is, you know, it's kind of cool.
Invisible Man's good. James Bond's great.
A bunch of Universal re-releases, actually.
Yeah,
pretty much every film they've ever made is being re-released on Blu-ray. So that's good. No, The Odd Couple on Blu-ray. I like that movie.
Yeah.
An Alfred Hitchcock Essential set, which is maybe Vertigo on Blu-ray will be more affordable. For some reason, that's not on Blu-ray, like, on its own, which I don't get. It's stupid.
It looks like, I think they released, like, a Hitchcock box set, and... they might be slowly putting them out one by one, like individually.
I think
it looks like Shadow of a Doubt too.
Okay.
But they were already released in the box set, so they might be doing that now.
All right.
Interesting. Okay, so that's that. Let's move then into the films coming out to theaters next week. June 7th, The Internship, The Purge, Much Ado About Nothing.
Yeah, I mean, Much Ado About Nothing looks kind of interesting.
Yeah, I hate Shakespeare, but this actually looks pretty good.
I'm kind of interested in The Purge.
Oh, boy.
I do want to see The Purge. It's a weird premise, and I'm one that I don't think holds up under any kind of scrutiny.
Yeah.
But it'll be interesting to see. My one concern is that, like, I'm not as much of a nihilist as I may come off. And I hate films that carry such a bleak view of humanity. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I'd like to believe that.
Well, that's why you should watch The Happening.
Oh, God. I mean, I want to now. I kind of want to check it out. Again, I'd kind of like to rewatch Lady in the Water, just to, to get some distance on them. But, like, with The Purge, it's just, like, it's so easy to take the worst view of humanity, but it's a lot harder to have any kind of optimism. And, like, when I was talking to some friends about The Purge, they were like, yeah, like, the crime is legal for, like, 12 hours. And then I said, you know, it's not just the fear of jail that keeps most people from killing each other. It's also just the inability morally to think about taking a human life.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't seem to agree. So I'm really concerned about my circle of friends now.
Ethan and I's favorite Twitter user, Thaddeus, made Imak Bakia _, as he's better known, made a tweet where he said, imagine being the senator who has to introduce the, for the next 12 hours, all crime is legal bill.
Yeah.
And, it sort of underscores the movie's, you know, just absolute nonsensical idea, which I kind of, that's the thing. That's what's gravitating me toward it. I want to see how that could possibly work. And from what I've heard, the movie's okay. So I think that,
well, my other thing is, like, okay, so all crime is legal for 12 hours, but then that's, like, a lot of arson, and then, like, who's cleaning up the bodies? Like,
well, yeah, and just think of all that torrenting.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Oh,
so.
God. Oh, God. I almost made the worst possible joke. Anyway, so let's talk about something else. Does anyone want to see The Internship?
No.
Okay.
I think I'll enjoy it as, like, a nostalgic thing where I feel like I'm living in 2006.
Yeah. Yeah.
Past that.
No. Why is Vince Vaughn still, like, cast in movies?
Yeah.
Excellent question. There is no answer. Okay, so The Purge, and anyone excited about Much Ado About Nothing?
I like Joss Whedon, but
I've heard good things.
Yeah, I've heard good things. I just, like,
yeah, but
I
there's haven't. So many other movies I'd rather watch.
That's yeah,
I sure. I think like Amy Acker though. So, and Fran Kranz.
Yeah. Anyway.
Okay, so let's really quickly say something that we've watched in the last week that we feel like you should check out, and then we can get out of these fine people's hair until next week. So, Ethan, let's start with you.
I will recommend The Green Ray, directed by Eric Romare. Has this film ever been brought up on this show? Ever?
No.
I just watched that the other day, actually.
Whoa! Yeah. The dual choice. Wow. I guess I should set up what this is about. Eric Romare, director of Claire's Knee, Pauline at the Beach, lots of talky French movies. But basically, it's about this secretary, I think she's a secretary, in Paris, Delphine, and the movie opens with her getting a phone call from her friend saying, oh, sorry, you know, that vacation we were supposed to have, I'm not going to be able to join you for that. And her being like, oh, I'm going to have to go on vacation by myself, and just being, oh. And then the rest of the movie is her kind of going through all these situations of kind of self-pity and kind of questioning her life over, having another person, being alone, I think it's interesting because I mentioned this character is very self-pitying, and I think a lot of people will probably, like, watch this movie and be like, oh, get over yourself already. But I think there's a certain faction of people like myself who will watch this movie and kind of relate to it in a lot of ways. And I actually related to it to, like, almost a devastating degree. And it's funny too, because I mean, also because there's this kind of, this character is kind of a bourgeois. I mean, the fact that she has the privilege to go on all these vacations, I think, is this irony that Romare points out, and it's interesting throughout the film. But again, I thought the movie was absolutely devastating. And it's the best Romare film I've seen so far, so I'd recommend it.
Ooh.
Ooh. All right. Nick, what about yourself?
I'm going to go with a choice that will please at least two of the other people on this podcast. I finally, for some reason, had put this off for a while. I finally watched Two Lovers.
Yes.
By Mr. James Gray. Oh, you've seen it too, Brian?
Yeah, actually, I own it. It's right there.
Oh, okay.
I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah, so, you know, with Gray premiering this new film of his, The Immigrant at Cannes, I kind of figured I should catch up with... I'd only seen We on the Night years before, and I didn't like it that much, but, you know, when you're like 14 or 15 years old, you kind of, you don't have as refined a taste. So I also rewatched that, and it's a great movie, and I apologize for not liking it. Sorry. I apologize for once not liking it, I should say. But Two Lovers is just, as they say, it's on a whole other level, I guess. The movie, I guess we could just talk about a visceral reaction I had, but the movie just killed me. Mm-hmm. It really just kind of hit me more forcefully than I was expecting, particularly the last 10 minutes of the movie, which is just so many emotions at once. It's every feeling that you could have, which Gray and his co-writer Richard Minello, a recently deceased man, adapting a Dostoevsky work, White Nights. You know, I mean, the way they kind of are spinning this tale of these two conflicting, kind of both slightly awkward relationships bound by this one man played by Joaquin Phoenix is, you know, I mean, there's a fascinating balance that's struck there. And there's sort of I guess the way that Gray is handling it as a filmmaker, too. He's a really exquisite director. I find it funny how he has talked about, he kind of prides himself on being an American filmmaker in the modern day who has an emphasis on narrative. But I think that his greatest strength is actually in mood and atmosphere. And sort of the way he perfectly nails that, you know, this small apartment that the guy lives in with his parents and the surrounding cold, oppressive Brighton Beach area to kind of the ultimate, the accumulation of it is, again, it's overpowering. This is a really masterful film. And if you haven't, there's a good chance people listening to it haven't seen it. I would say please, please watch it. It's not at all difficult to get your hands on. And if you don't, I don't know. I don't want to know a person who is not hugely impacted by the end of this movie. Honestly, it is so... Oh, God. Yeah, this movie really, really hit me. I also have to say, too, one last thing. It's funny how this is sort of like the last movie, aside from that stupid Casey Affleck documentary, this is the last movie that Joaquin Phoenix made before The Master.
Right.
And it's interesting how there's kind of I think there's sort of a carrying over between the two roles in a way. And as a fan of Joaquin Phoenix, it was nice to kind of see that bridge of sorts, how he's kind of playing variations on a similar person. I think that, you know, Freddie Quinn, The Master, is sort of like, if the ending of this movie went completely wrong, that's sort of how he would turn out.
I think Merrill House in Signs was the first.
Oh, okay. All right. In that bridge. Yes. Anyway. All right. So, yeah, I mean, it's just, if you can't tell already, I really love this movie.
All right.
Really, really loved it.
Yay.
Yay. Danny, what about yourself?
All right. Wow. You know, tough to follow up those two picks. I'm going to genre it up a little bit with Hollow Man.
Oh, nice. I love that movie.
Yeah. Wow. Nick or Ethan, have you seen it?
I saw that in the theater. Yeah.
You saw it in the theater.
Wow, oh, man.
I
remember wanting to see it in the theater and not being allowed.
That's bold. 7 years old. And,
what? I guess I saw Blair Witch Project in the theater, so I guess my parents allowed me.
Although Hollow Man is like much worse.
Hollow Man is straight up evil.
I mean, it was, the movie really...
About a dim view of humanity.
Good, though.
It's good, yeah.
Nick?
I think I remember liking it, but I didn't really...
I guess if you're that young, you wouldn't know how to like it.
Yeah, I didn't really...
It's like, it's a very kind of interesting treatment on sort of like voyeurism. And I feel like if the movie came out today, it would be one of those movies that gets an F on CinemaScore.
Oh, absolutely.
Because it's like, it's sold as like a Kevin Bacon horror movie. And yet, Kevin Bacon, you don't really see his face for like 3/4 of it. And a lot of the scares aren't even jump scares. They're more just kind of like creepy. Like, I am watching Kevin Bacon as a ghost, like, rape a woman scares. So yeah. It's kind of a disturbing film.
I remember I really wanted to see that movie because when I was a little kid, I was really into, the Movie Magic was, I think, the show on, like, the Discovery or something. And it was all about, like, special effects and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And so they had episodes on, like, you know, Terminator 2 and then Starship Troopers. And then, like, I remember Hollow Man being a big thing because it's like, whoa, we're using, like, this brand new technology to make, like, an invisible man and, like, still have him interact with the world and, like, you know, move through smoke and you can see him. And then I saw it and I was just like, holy shit, it's pretty fucking dark.
it's been a while since I've seen it. I'd really like to rewatch it.
And I would say the effects still hold up really well. It's kind of a stunning movie to look at. I would say the last third gets a little bit one note with the kind of Kevin Bacon trying to kill everyone angle, and it loses a bit of its kind of subversive edge, but overall it's really worth seeing.
All right, excellent. So Hollow Man, which was, oh man, when did that come out? That was 2000. Jesus.
Yeah.
All right, directed by the inestimable Paul Verhoeven, which is just incredible. He did Starship Troopers too, didn't he?
Of course.
Damn,
yeah.
Yeah, man.
And my favorite, Showgirls.
Oh, Showgirls. All right. Ah, man, now I wish I'd watched Starship Troopers because I'd love to be able to follow up Hollow Man with that. Instead, I watched We Bought a Zoo, which is not quite on the same level as Starship Troopers or Hollow Man. Has everyone seen We Bought a Zoo?
No, I have actually.
I haven't, no.
All right, Ethan, did you like it?
Not really.
Not really? No? All right.
Yeah, I saw that.
Danny, did you like it?
I didn't really like it when I saw it, but since then, I have, like, grown to like Matt Damon so much that I wonder if I would like it a little more.
Okay.
Is it?
Interesting. I saw it in the theater, and I saw it, obviously this week, and it holds up. I kind of like it. I kind of enjoy it. It's like so obviously like I think it plays the heartstrings like Jimi Hendrix, like just wailing on a guitar, but like, you know, that kind of works for me. And there's a lot of really like intense empathetic emotional beats, and you know, most of the comedy lands. And the score is fantastic.
Oh, no, that's something I'm going to have to disagree with.
Oh, really? Are you a fan of Sigaros?
No.
No, well, I am, so there's a fundamental difference at heart. It's on HBO, I believe, so if you have HBO, you can go on HBO Go or VOD On Demand. And, I say check it out.
And I feel like it'll be permanently on airplanes for, like, the rest of human.
It is the most like perfectly okay, everything's acceptable movie ever. Like, I can't think of a beat in it that's really like gonna like raise anyone's eyebrows. There is a drunk Scotsman constantly saying he's gonna kill someone, but other than that,
I remember being a little creeped out by how like the mother was put in. Is that a thing that was weird or no?
I don't think so.
Okay. Or the wife? Like,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, every once in a while she just appears because that's how much he misses her. I don't know. Fuck it.
Is it like MacGruber?
I never saw MacGruber. So I'm
oh, not so you don't get that joke. Okay. See MacGruber.
I will do that. I've actually heard from a lot of people that I should. So maybe that'll be my next week's discussion. But that's it for this week. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for sticking with us. It's been a long episode, but I think we talked a lot about a lot of good stuff. So let's say where we can be found online. Ethan, let's start off with you.
You can find me at twitter.com/DevinFerracci. No, just kidding. You can find me at twitter.com/EthanVess, and I contribute to the Film Stage every once in a while, and I'd like to contribute more, and so maybe in the future we'll see more stuff.
All right. Excellent. Danny, what about yourself?
Yes, thefilmstage.com, absolutely. Thekingbulletin.com and twitter.com/thekingbulletin.
And Nick?
Yeah, filmstage.com, twitter.com/Nick_Newman, and taking an E.
Ranger. Yeah.
Oh, God. And I can be found on twitter.com/BrianJRowan, at thefilmstage.com, and at my personal site, dearfilm.net. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much, and join us next week. Someone should get that.
I'm not going to answer that. It's probably like a French telemarketer.
What?
It'll be over soon enough.
You have a lot of problem with French telemarketers?
There's a lot of them.
Sir, do you have a problem making crepes? I don't know why I assume they'd be selling you a crepe maker.
Yeah.
I hope this part stays in. Oh, for fuck's sakes. Maybe, okay, you know what? I actually am going to answer it. Hold on.
Hold on one second.
Oh, God, the French telemarketers found him.
Yeah, that could be a telemarketer.
Would it be worse or better if it was a Portuguese telemarketer?
Anyway.